There always seems to be a sense that there's something wrong. There's some sort of gap somewhere. Maybe a struggle for validation. Am I truly loved? And with all the struggles and inner thoughts and inconsistencies and stuff in each of our lives, will anyone accept me? Arthur Miller, who wrote The Death of a Salesman, pretty famous author, talks about how throughout his life, he always carried around this sense of judgment, that there was a disconnect somewhere between who he was and everything else around him. And even when he stopped believing in God, he eventually moved on to atheism. He said there was always this sense that he needed to prove himself to others, that there was something, some sort of validation that he was always seeking. And he said he never wanted that feeling, but it was always there. And later in life, when he reflected upon all this, he looked back and he said, look, I took this need to be approved by God that he sort of even points into hardwiring to a need to be approved by others. And there is this gap. There is this uniqueness to the gap that God will speak to throughout Scripture and ultimately deal with. But one of the first ways God starts speaking to that gap, the gap of understanding sin and evil and brokenness and wanting to be loved and wanting to be desired and wanting to be made right and wanting all those sort of things. And at first, God steps into that gap with this conversation about priests. And we're introduced to this concept in Exodus, but we actually saw it already back in Exodus 19. It said this, and God was speaking to his people. He says, "Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now, this came before the Ten Commandments, before all the last kind of weeks that we've walked through. When God finally leads them to Sinai, he makes this statement to them. So what does God mean? What is a whole kingdom of priests? Like, we're all priests? Like, all the millions of Israelites who are there are priests now? What does that look like? Because priests was hardly an exclusive idea to Judaism. We certainly see, even in Moses' life, his father-in-law is a priest in Midian. Egyptians had priests. Canaanites had priests. It was not an uncommon idea. Now, priests in just about every system, in almost all the sort of faith systems that are out there, sort of function in some ways as a sort of go-between, sort of mediator between the people and God, or people and the gods, depending on the background. And we understand this in a lot of ways, this whole idea of this in-between. The best way I've heard it explained, I think Tim Mackey used this, is this idea of like your automobile. Now, your automobile can run fine. And right now, like, my automobile has some issues. I have no AC in my car. Summertime's coming. It's been pretty rough. And I open the hood of my car and I don't know what to do. Like, it is broken and I don't know how to fix this. It's one thing to change the oil or some fluids in the car. It's another thing to just open the hood and be like, I don't know what I can do. I need somebody else to help me here. And I don't really think about it unless it's broken, but I am not qualified to fix my car. So I need to go to the sacred space of the mechanic. And I say sacred space in the right way. They are set apart for a particular purpose, to repair automobiles. That is what the place is for. And there's even this priesthood of individuals who have uniforms that help make them distinct, these onesies that they wear that separate them from everybody else in the shop. And they have a particular role to play. Their sole purpose is to use their qualified status and knowledge to do this job. So when I have a broken car, I have this large gap of knowledge between what I currently am experiencing and how to navigate. I need to navigate that gap to fix it. So this is an everyday thing. We find this in just about every profession. But what happens when that gap is about sin, brokenness, the spiritual things of life? That's where the priesthood comes in. Now, much of the explanation of the role of priesthood is really spelled out in the book of Leviticus, but we do begin in Exodus with some pictures here, and we get a description of their clothes, and then we get a description of sort of their consecration, their sort of setting us apart. And so we're going to walk through some of these pieces. So let's start in chapter 28, verse 1. "Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother," so Moses' brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve to me as priests. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all the skillful whom I have filled with the spirit of skill that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood. And we'll deal with the skilled people another week. These are the garments that they make them: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checker worn, a turban, a sash. They shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, and his sons to serve me as priests. And so all of chapter 28 becomes this whole idea of these clothings. Now, here's a picture of sort of the two different outfits that priests were to wear. There was a part of the outfit that all priests wore. There was a tunic, this sort of headpiece, these undergarments. Often there were these linen white pieces. And then the high priest had this unique collection of clothing, this breastplate that they wore, this ephod and robe and diadem, all these kind of pieces of the outfit. And we'll talk through all those different pieces. And we'll have a couple of notes on how God is actually telling a story through these people's clothing. It seems like if there's one chapter to skip in all the Old Testament, it's the one about priest clothing, because we don't have the priesthood anymore. Why are we even reading it? But there's still these pictures and these ideas, I think, are presented through the priests that for us to really understand. And the first is that the priest role is intricately tied to the temple. Just by their clothing, it is intricately tied to the temple. Exodus 28:31, you shall make your robe of the ephod all of blue. Exodus 28:39, you shall weave the coat, a checker, work of fine linen. You shall make the turban of fine linen. You shall make a sash embroidered with needlework. Exodus 39:29, the sash of fine twined linen of blue and purple and scarlet yarns embroidered with needlework. And the Lord commanded Moses. And regarding, once again, the high priest garments, 28:6-9, they shall be the ephod of gold and blue and purple and scarlet yarns and the fine twine linen skillfully worked. Now, if you were paying attention last week when we talked through the tabernacle, one of the descriptions was about the curtain in the tabernacle. And it was all of this fabric. The blue, the scarlet, the purple needlework of yarn, these sort of sash, and then the gold being interwoven amongst it. This is intentionally meant to match the curtains of the tabernacle. And so the priesthood is wearing, it's like wearing the hotel carpet while also working at the hotel. It is matching the perfect place to say, like, oh, clearly you are connected to this location. The priest's work was a tabernacle, and their clothes were meant to reflect that. And the priests also were designed to represent all of Israel. Exodus 28:6-9, and they make that ephod of gold, of blue, purple, scarlet yarns that we just read about. And it shall have two shoulder pieces attached to its two edges, so that it may be joined together. And the skillfully woven band on it shall be made like it, and be of one piece with it, of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, of fine twined linen. And you shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel. So that's on their shoulders, and then the ephod includes this breast piece on it, the sort of central square, and it says this on verse 21, there shall be 12 stones with their names according to the names of the sons of Israel, and they shall be like signets, each engraved with its name for the 12 tribes. So the high priest wears this thing with these two stones on the corners, and six of the tribes were written on one stone, and six of the tribes were written on the other, and there's a picture kind of this as well. And they're inscribed with the names of the tribes to be a memorial before their God. So they would include that, and not only that, but this breastplate with, you know, like stones going across it, and each of those stones has the name of a different tribe upon it. And it's described as over the heart of the priest. It's interesting. Author Murray Capel says, in Hebraic thought, the heart is the core of our entire being. It is the center and soul of who we are, comprising the seat of all of our thoughts, our feelings, our actions. The heart is the real us. And so God is telling the priest through their clothing, look, you will put on the 12 tribes. And when you come into the place, you have these symbols that you are representing all 12 tribes, all these millions of Israelites. You are coming into the tabernacle showcasing. And not only that, but you were to wear them not only on your shoulders, you bear the weight of the 12 tribes, but you also keep them close to your heart. But the high priest represents Israel not only in the actions, but out of love and compassion of the people he serves. It's a personal heart task for them as well. And they represent all of Israel, sometimes even the decision-making. They have these Urim and Thummim, and they're these, we don't actually know what they are, which is even crazier, that they might be these parchment or these white and black stones. There's all sorts of thoughts on what they might have been. But before the prophets really show up to help lead and direct Israel, they sometimes function to help lead and direct Israel in sort of almost kind of casting lots kind of way. So the priest was to represent Israel, and the priest was designed to look different. They weren't meant to look like the surrounding religions. Exodus 28:42, "You shall make for them linen garments to cover their naked flesh, and they shall reach from their hips to their thighs." So they would include these clothes, and they would make sure that they had underpants on. And some of the surrounding religions would worship God with nakedness, and God expected his people to be different than the surrounding nations. He already said this in Exodus 20:26, "You shall not go up the steps of the altar that your nakedness be exposed on it." There was not supposed to be any sort of sexual practices tied into the temple or tabernacle worship, and the priests are told very explicitly to set themselves apart differently in how they clothe themselves. It even says, set apart in the language by Exodus 28:36, "You shall make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it, like the engraving of a signet, holy to the Lord." So the high priest's garments themselves literally say, set apart to the Lord. And notice, there's no sandals or something like that. And I think this is to recall Moses' experience with the burning bush, that they would not wear shoes in front of, there's no instructions on shoes for the priests. But they are told that they are to be set apart. So this priest just dresses differently. Let's look at that picture again, just the standard picture of the high priest. Now, does this look like something you'd want to wear wandering around the desert for 40 years in? It's heavy. There's a lot of metal on it. It makes you look very different and very distinct. And that's purposeful because our God is different. Yahweh is different than the gods of this world. That's what makes him holy. He is distinct from the gods that we can imagine and create in our own minds. Even someone like Josephus, this ancient historian, talks about how like cosmically removed you were when you saw the high priest. It was meant to be like, this person's from another world. That is the point. And the word being different, the set apart, the word kadosh, is a word we translate as holy. And one of the reasons for the tabernacle is to put it in the middle of the camp and have these priests work the tabernacle. And all the Israelites are to watch these priests, and they would learn what it actually looks like to be a priest to the world. The priests look different. They act different. They do different things. They think about economy and stuff like that differently. They give away the surplus of everything they have. Their sexuality is functioning differently. That is a showcase for Israel to now live out these differences as well. They even have things like pomegranates and gold bells on the edges of their clothes. So there was even auditory clues of how different they were. It's like suddenly you would hear, almost like walking into Walmart kind of at Christmas time, there would be that bell and you would know that that person's there ringing that bell, fundraising. There was all these ideas tied into that. The same thing was true. You would hear the bells of the priests and you would immediately think of sacred things, holy things, sacrifice, all these sort of pictures. But with all of these sort of setups, there's also this idea that like, we can't just go into the tabernacle. There are so many steps that the priests have to go through to put on these clothes, to do all these sort of things just to be in service to the Lord. There's a lot of prep, there's a lot of details and all this. And I think the next chapter starts heading into that. Exodus 29, we'll read a larger chunk here. "Now this is what you shall do to them to consecrate them, that they may serve at me as priests. Take one bull of the herd, two rams without blemish, unleavened bread, unleavened cakes mixed with oil, unleavened wafers smeared with oil. You shall make them of fine wheat flour. You shall put them in the one basket and bring them in the basket. It shall be a bull and two rams. You shall bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance of the tent of meeting and wash them in water." It's the first thing that happens to them. "Then you shall take the garments and put on Aaron the coat and the robe of the ephod and the piece. The breastpiece, the gird him with the skillfully woven band of the ephod. You shall set the turban on his head and put his holy crown on his turban. You shall take the anointing oil, pour it on his head and anoint him. Then you shall bring the sons, put coats on them, and they shall gird Aaron and his sons with sashes and bind caps on them. And the priesthood shall be theirs by a statute forever. Thus you shall ordain Aaron and his sons." Now the rest of the chapter keeps going through a lot of instructions here. There's a lot of dead bodies. There's like fat and liver and all this kind of stuff. A little bit gory sometimes for our sensibilities. But I think there's big lessons here. The sort of consecration, the sort of preparation for and setting apart of Aaron and his sons through all of this sacrifice. I think the first thing we learn is that God uses ordinary people. Like all this practice of bloodshed was needed because the priests that God is using at the end of the day are ordinary people being prepared for an extraordinary role. They're sinful, they're broken, they're imperfect. And so for God to start this process, he's saying, look, for these men to be in this role, there's going to need to be some death. Now we'll get to atonement in a second and what all of that means, but it's taking ordinary people and setting them apart through all this to be extraordinary. And the writer of Hebrews reminds us of this, Hebrews 5. For every high priest chosen among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward since he himself is beset with weaknesses. Because of this, he's obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So the writer of Hebrews is noting this same thing, that these people would come in, and if you were the role of the high priest, like you have to also deal with your own sin as the high priest. So the priest had to bring his own animals and do his own sacrifices for his role. Now there's good and bad because of this, because there is some good. If the high priest is kind of like us, then we have one who understands pain, hurt, temptation, sin, all the things that we are going to need the system for, the priesthood, these animals, all the things that we need it for. We have a high priest who understands what we all struggle with. And it's also good news that God can set apart. God can take very ordinary people like you and me, and take them and make them extraordinary, consecrate them, make them for himself. There's nothing special about Aaron and his family other than God has called them to be priests. Now, there's a bad side to all this, too. First of all, the high priest can't possibly know whatever we struggle with. Like when the high priest goes in to the tabernacle, and I talked about this a little bit, but the sacrifices are brought in and blood is spilled, and all this is tied into this idea of like how God sort of reconciles and forgives our sin. But the high priest doesn't know you. The high priest doesn't know the millions of people in Israel. He might have a few acquaintances. He might know some of the details of really people's struggles, but most of the time when he's going into the tabernacle, it's vague. It's probably a catch-all. Here's the sins that Israel has today, and I'm atoning for them. He just doesn't know. And not only that, but the same sins that beset him, the wage, the payment is death. And so each of these priests still die. Hebrews reminds us of this. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. And so we constantly see death in Aaron's family. So that's a reminder that we do have a God who uses ordinary people. But not only that, in this priesthood, that we see that we're not trying to get to God, but God is making a way to get his people back to him. Because we wrap up this whole section in Exodus 29. There I will meet with the people of Israel, and it shall be sanctified by my glory. I will consecrate the tent and meeting in the altar. Aaron and his sons, I will consecrate to serve me as priests, and I will dwell among the people of Israel, and I will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. Now, emphasis added there, but I hope we notice the constant statements of God saying, I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. All the establishment of the tent, the priesthood, these sacrifices is about God moving towards us. This is so counter sort of the setup of the roles of temples and mountains and stuff in ancient world. That was about the people kind of moving back towards the place of the gods. But here, God is firm to say, hold on, I am coming to you. This is not about you coming back to me, but me coming to you. and we see any sacrifices. And through the whole book of Leviticus, the priest's role was also to help us navigate atonement, to understand atonement. Now let's talk about atonement for a second, because I've used the word a few times. So that fundamental question, the one I even started with, why is the world the way it is? What could be done about it? Particularly in relation to evil and sin. Why is there evil? Why is it pervasive? What is this brokenness? And how do we possibly fix it? And some of that is explicit, that the evil, the stuff like we have things like murder and stealing and lying and hatred, all the things that sometimes we readily identify as brokenness and sin, but there's also consequences of all those that play themselves out. Sin sort of messes with the environment around it. There's distrust and emotional damage and things like that. And we get to the question, like, why, if we have a good God, why doesn't God just do something about the evil and sin in the world? But if we're honest, and we understand also God's word, the evil that we see all around us is also the evil that's in us, the sin that's in us. So if God's going to get rid of evil in the world, he has to get rid of us. But God, through these priests in this tabernacle, has set up a process for his people. That there's this powerful symbol through animal sacrifice. That God is allowing through this animal's life and the taking of this animal life to be a substitute. Symbolically dying in our place. This is the word atonement, to cover over someone's death. And so this is sort of the practice God sets up, the economy God sets up for his people to say, look, yes, I should wipe you all out. But instead of bringing you death, I'm giving you this option of this animal. But as stated, sin has effects beyond the person. And if the effects even on the larger environment around it, so what the priest would do is not only would the killing of the animal happen on the outskirts, but they would take all the blood and then sprinkle it inside the tabernacle. And last week, if the tabernacle is supposed to be this larger picture of the cosmos, the world, the priest is sort of purifying the environment that sin has now affected as well. It's all this symbolism tied in. And the book of Leviticus provides a whole layout of the practices of atonement. All sorts of details, like what sort of animals should you bring when you do these certain things? How do they need to prepare? What part of the animal should be used? It's quite a lot of details, and we're certainly not going to get into that. But the role of the priest would be to help people to understand, to navigate, and to be sort of the setup of God's system, of how they are cleansed from their sin and from their evil, and how things are made right again. Now, the hope for Israel through all this is that one could be cleansed and actually walk out faith and obedience, but we will see this to be a struggle. And that obedience thing was even a picture that the priest had too. The priest's role were to distribute food and care for the poor and justice issues and helping understand obedience and helping understand generosity and the rules related to sexuality. This was sort of the picture of what it looks like to actually live a clean, atoned life. But we see by the prophet Isaiah coming around, you know, we find out that these sacrifices are insufficient in the way that they never transform the heart. That people would offer sacrifices, but then allow great evil, ignoring the poor, the oppressed, distorting justice, practicing idolatry. And Isaiah comes around going, look, all these sacrifices are not doing what we ultimately need. And this is where we need a better priest and a better system. And that's where Jesus comes along. It's really interesting. We're walking through recording in the 2-year Bible right now on like these very chapters that unpack this whole idea of Jesus taking on this role. Because the writer of Hebrews reminds us in Hebrews 8. Now, the point is in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest. One who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. So the writer of Hebrews is saying, look, that whole thing on the earth with the high priest and Aaron's family and this tabernacle that was set up, we have something greater, more cosmic, more spiritual than sort of the physical tent that existed in Israel. And Jesus is this high priest in a greater tabernacle. And in so doing, we see pictures that match what we have already unpacked about the priest. That in so doing, he represents us all. Just as the high priest represented the 12 tribes by all the symbolism on his body, Jesus represents the nations in the work, in his work through those who believe. Hebrews 6, 19. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, the writer of Hebrews goes on for a few chapters on this topic, but I want to summarize because we're not going to spend forever unpacking the whole Melchizedek thing. But in the system that we have been reading about in Exodus, this covenant that's set up with God is about God and Israel. And Aaron, sort of this go-between between God and the people of Israel, Jacob's family out of the 12 sons that are the 12 tribes. But Jesus is like this Old Testament random figure of Melchizedek that's like given like a whole two verses in the Old Testament. And what the writer of Hebrews is pointing out is his connection, the connection that Jesus is a priest way further back than anything we read about in Exodus. Long before that, to Abraham. Abraham, who had a very different covenant than the Moses one. Moses one was tied into land and blessing and the 12 tribes. Abraham was about blessing the nations, the whole world, a covenant based upon faith. And the priest that was connected to Abraham was this guy, Melchizedek. So Jesus is like that, a priest for the world. And his tabernacle is not just this temporary structure on earth, but a heavenly one. He represents us all. He is set apart. Hebrews 7:26 says this, "For it was indeed fitting that he should have such a high priest, holy," which is the word set apart, "innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens." In Jesus, we see the picture of true humanity, as it was designed to be, without sin and blemish. His very life was distinct. It was not about the clothing that he wore, but the life that he actually lived. Well, there was nothing actually special about his physical appearance, but God ultimately is after holy hearts that lead holy lives. And Jesus is truly set apart as the only truly holy one. And he knows our sin. Having become like us, he knows our sin. Remember how I said there was actually a benefit to the high priest actually being human like us? Well, the writer of Hebrews points out that same benefit. Hebrews 4, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." And so, as I said, one of the struggles of the ancient priests is that they don't know the 1 million, 2 million, 3 million people in Israel. And they're going in there trying to represent the sins before the Father, but they're just trying their best, making best broad guesses. And the writer of Hebrews says, hold on, we have a better high priest than that. One who, yes, was like us as a human, tempted, struggled, pain and hurt, all those sort of things were part of his life. But he's also God and can represent all of us. And so the encouragement that the writer of Hebrews has is going, he knows us. He's able to actually individually know each of our struggles and yet go before the Father for us and take what is our brokenness to the Father and say, forgive, 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 and can intercede over and over and over. We have a merciful and sympathetic priest. And lastly, Jesus helps us understand atonement. It's interesting, because Jesus didn't have sin, when he goes into the temple, he's not bringing his own animals with him. There's nothing for him to bring other than himself. And we read this last week, Hebrews 9. "For Christ has entered not into holy places made by hands, but a copy of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as a high priest enters a holy place every year with blood not his own. And then he would have to had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once and for all at the end of ages to put away sin by his sacrifice of himself. And just as it was appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly awaiting for him." So what's the answer to sin and evil? Is it a constant practice in the temple? Is it constantly needing to atone for sin, to have a certain amount of guilt, to suffer a certain amount, to have to absolve someone? Is that the practice? Is that how we understand sin? No, Jesus takes on the role of the atoning one, the cleansing one by his very life. Not by bulls and goats. If you want your conscience cleansed, we finally have the one who can do it. The one perfect human sacrifice, the one that died. And when he returned to life, finishing once and for all the need to put to death, death. No more sacrifices, conquering death, your sin, my sin, by faith, are actually dealt with in Jesus. And now the sort of final step of the gospel, that same power that brought Jesus, our atonement, back from the dead, it's the same power in us now. And it brings a change in us that the Israelites had never experienced, a new heart, new desires. That's why we become this new priesthood, as Peter will say to the church. We now live out as mediators in a way to the world that they may know what God is like and they may know who God is through us. That we may intercede for our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, our classmates, that we may show and tell about who God is and how atonement can happen through Jesus' work, that we live holy, distinct, unique lives reflective of Jesus, the only true one. The only true Holy One who lives a life of love and peace for us so that we can do the same. Let me pray for us. God, these past few weeks have been some of the more grand and large topics in Scripture, and yet, God, you spend pages and time and paragraphs and words telling us about priests and telling us about temples and tabernacles and giving us all these pictures. Pictures that for 1,000+ years were practiced and practiced and practiced. And yet in Jesus, God, we also see the grander picture that those things were pointing to. They were but shadows of the reality. And so God, may we find such tremendous grace in the good news, that Jesus is the one who ultimately deals with the problem of sin and evil in this world. A hole we cannot dig ourselves out of, a death we cannot resurrect ourselves from. That he is the greater priest, standing in the gap between us and the Father, the King. God, may we also understand our role now to live out, empowered by Christ's Spirit, live out what it looks like to be priests of this world, be little reflections and mediators of you to the world, and to bless the nations because of what Christ did, because Christ is our true atonement. I pray all this in your name. Amen. Thanks, y'all.